For any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss voter protection issues with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Public Policy Director Tanya Clayhouse, new statistics for Social Security reserves with Economic Policy Institute economist Monique Morrissey, and the Next Generation of Government Summit with GovLoop founder and president Steve Ressler. But first, AFGE District 14 National Representative Johnny Walker joins us to discuss an affordable housing program for D.C. government workers. Johnny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jason. It's always good to be with you.
So, Johnny, AFGE's 14th District was part of a coalition to offer union members who work in the D.C. government first choice at affordable housing in the district. Tell us about this project that you were involved in.
Well, we're excited. This is just one of many. We're full of resources now, so much so it's really hard for us to share the information with our D.C. government employees. But the first one today is actually the last day, the 27th, that D.C. government workers are being offered first choice to purchase new homes at a discounted rate. Open houses are usually from 1 to 4 p.m., so hopefully, and then from today, the 27th, from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., so we hope that people will get out. And that community is called Metro Towns at Parkside, which is on the Orange Line. It's right up near 295, Route 50. These are three-bedroom homes. They haven't started construction yet, but you can the pricing begins at $259,000, down payment as low as $1,000. So this is a brand new community in Northeast, the Deanwood section of Washington, D.C.
Johnny, talk a little bit about what it took to get this benefit provided for D.C. government workers and union members.
Well, we're happy that this particular project was created by the former Wizards basketball owner, Abe Poland, and his wife. And this this community is named after two of their deceased children, Linda Joy and Kenneth J. Poland. So this is an Abe Poland project, and he wanted affordable housing for D.C. government employees to be able to live in the District of Columbia. So he made this possible, even after his death, to create affordable housing. This started really, Jason, just to give you just a little history. In 2003, then Mayor Anthony Williams started a campaign to bring 100,000 new residents back to D.C. within 10 years. So we're approaching the 10-year mark. We're not quite at the $100,000 residents, new residents mark yet, but almost halfway. In 1950, there were about 800,000 residents of the District of Columbia. Currently, in 2012, there's just over 601,000. So Anthony Williams started by bringing police officers who were living in Prince George's County, teachers who were living in Prince George's County. He brought them back to live in the communities in which they served. And then he started other programs through D.C. Housing Office to create affordable housing for D.C. residents. And today, like I said, this is just one initiative that I just spoke of. And if we have time, I can share with you at least two others that we're currently working along with the D.C. Metro Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO.
Johnny, talk about the eligibility. Who's able to take advantage of this unique offer?
At this current time, all D.C. government employees are eligible to participate, especially with this new Metro Towns program. So that is the first criteria. Like I said, it's as much as or as little as $500 down, and the rest coming from the employee assistance program. So there are grants being offered through various lenders such as Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and other lenders that Metro Towns is working with. Again, right now, that's the first criteria, Jason, that all D.C. government employees, no matter what your level of income is.
Johnny, let's talk about the significance of having a plan like this. What's the impact going to be on some of the economic development in the district with this?
Well, one that I just spoke of, which is a brand new community, Metro Towns, D.C., and if anybody wants to look, you can just go to metrotownsdc.com and look at the plan for yourself. Through the D.C. Department of Housing and Community Development, which AFGE Local 2725, we're happy to say, represents those employees at that agency, are offering several home ownership purchase assistance programs, Jason, such as a employee-assisted housing program, the home purchase assistance program, the negotiated employee affordable home purchase program, home purchase rehabilitation pilot program, and the home purchase assistance program. The home purchase assistance program, to answer your question, in terms of economic development and revitalization of some of the targeted areas that are not doing too well, but there's some special programs in the Deanwood area, the historic Anacostia area, the Ivy City, Trinidad area, Northeast, and these properties are eligible for purchase, again, for D.C. government employees. That's just one. Then you have the Employee Assistance Housing Program. The purchase price of no more than $417,000, which is a little down as $5,000 again, Jason. Then the Home Purchase Assistance Program, and then we negotiated one through the negotiated contract, which is called Compensation 1 and 2. All the D.C. government employees that are unionized are eligible to participate in just another program. So like I'm telling you, there's so much information. There's at least three or four separate tracks, including credit repair, Jason, and coupled in all of these different programs, if you're able to get assistance or grants, you can couple all of these grants together. And out of pocket, little or nothing, and also you can have credit counseling. So if employees are just take a little time to study and do the research, and I know it's overwhelming because we're being inundated. Even right now, we just got a call from Manna, who is another home ownership program, leading nonprofit that supports home ownership for district residents. They've reached out to us with a program called Own Now. Again, seeking all D.C. government employees to participate. The economic impact for the district is great. And again, with the vision of former Mayor Anthony Williams to bring 100,000 employees or residents back to the District of Columbia, this is definitely helping.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Johnny Walker, AFGE's 14th District National Representative. Johnny, what's the interest been from AFGE members on this housing offer?
The interest has been, I think, very good. The interest is also, we've gotten calls from as far away as Atlanta, Georgia, North Carolina, from federal employees who are also interested in this, even though we clearly said right now this is being offered to D.C. government employees. So we've shared this with the different entities, with D.C. Housing Authority, with the Amy Poland Foundation, and some other nonprofits, to see if we can expand this for federal government employees. As well, as you may or may not know, there are 240,000 federal workers that come in and out of D.C. Daily to commute, and 45,000 of those employees are D.C. residents. So if we can get out of that 240 people who are willing and wanting to purchase affordable housing in D.C., the response so far, like I said, we have gotten calls from federal employees who are hoping that this program expands to federal employees as well.
Johnny, of course, you were a former local president, head of AFGE's D.C. Local 383. Do you sense that programs like these will help boost the morale of D.C. government workers and union members?
Oh, no doubt. Like I said, working in your own community, as I said, with the police department, police officers are now living in the communities that they patrol. Teachers are now living in communities in which they teach. So there's a sense of pride in ownership, one, and being able to live where you work in the commute. As you know, if anybody who knows D.C., commuting back and forth, either from Northern Virginia or Maryland, is pretty arduous on anybody and costly. So, yeah, it's definitely a morale booster for employers. And home ownership, number one, why many residents, many D.C. employees moved out of the district in the first place because they felt they couldn't afford to own a home in the District of Columbia. So they felt affordable housing was available in Maryland and Virginia easier than it was in D.C., and now that's not the case. There is affordable housing in D.C., and it's being offered to D.C. employees. And so we're hoping that our members take advantage of these opportunities. They're amazing.
Johnny Walker, AFGE's 14th District National Representative. Johnny, thank you so much for your time and telling us about this issue.
Thanks, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss voter protection issues with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Public Policy Director Tanya Clayhouse.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Tanya Clayhouse, the Public Policy Director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Tanya, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Tanya, as the 2012 election season heats up, what can you tell us about some voter protection concerns that you might have going forward?
Sure. You know, with the election season, we typically see a much more attention being paid to voters and certain demographics of voters, particularly on either side of the party spectrum. And what you have oftentimes are some groups that are going to be much more inclined to try to put together certain tactics that will, I think, lessen the ability of certain groups to be able to go to the polls and vote. For example, we're seeing more types of suppression laws that are being put in place across the, that are being attempted to be put in place in some of the states, particularly on restrictive types of identification, not simply ID, which could be your voter registration card, but we're talking about very restrictive forms where you're talking about an unexpired driver's license or passport or a certain type of government-issued ID, which a lot of people, particularly if you're not driving, you just don't have. Or if you're elderly, you don't have these types of identification or are not able to get it. So there's that type of issue. There's also restrictions on early voting that we're seeing in states like Florida. And so you have less time to go out and vote before the polling, before regular election day, which is challenging. And then we're seeing other types of deceptive practices and intimidation tactics that also take place. We've had instances, we already know that there is an organization called Truth the Vote that is, it has committed to trying to get at least 1 million people to train and challenge people at the polling place, which, again, you kind of wonder, we're in this day and age right now, and why is it that we're at a point where you know, people are actually trying to challenge people when they're trying to exercise their right to vote.
Tanya, what's behind this? Why do you think that there are some of these efforts to suppress or restrict voters?
I think we think that it is, it comes up because there, you know, we have a changing population right now, and oftentimes those who are in power want to stay in power, and this becomes more political exercise that we believe, while it is targeted, sadly, it tends to be targeted against particularly people of color, both African-American, Latino, as well as Asian-Americans, but also student voters and, as I mentioned, the elderly and people with disabilities. And we believe that what certain groups that are targeting these types of demographic populations, it's done so because they believe that they're going to vote a particular way, and that therefore if they target them and try to challenge their ability to engage in the franchise, that this will enable them to remain in power and move forward and not have to worry about being voted out of office or not being able to get certain other people in office. So we do see it as something as political, and sadly, again, because of the some of the racial issues that underlie a lot of these types of suppression laws, I mean, it becomes a racial discrimination issue as well.
Tanya, what are some of these groups that are being targeted? What are they doing in response to fight back against these efforts?
Absolutely. Well, we have not only the Lawyers Committee, it works with a host of organizations. We help to lead and organize what is called the Election Protection Coalition. And that is a coalition comprised of upwards of 150 organizations, including groups like Common Cause, as well as the NAACP, as well as the National Urban League, the ACLU, National Council of RASA. I mean, there's, NLEO. We work with a host of civil rights and voting rights organizations that come together to try to not only educate people about their rights and ensure that they have the information that is necessary so that they can get out and vote, but also provide them with the resources to combat these challenges. So, for example, the Election Protection Coalition provides an 866 Our Vote hotline. It's national. So if you have a problem at the polling place, you can call that number and you can obtain assistance. We have trained legal volunteers that are answering your calls. We also provide materials, as well as we put out information. For example, we recently released a report called, we call it Got ID. It's helping Americans get voter identification. And so what that does is it provides you with information on how to get your ID in those states that do have these restrictive voter identification laws, because it's not just about stopping these restrictive laws, but it's also about, as you said, preparing people to just deal with them as necessary. So we have reports and information like this. We have toolkits on our website at 866ourvote.org. That's the election protection website, as I said, and we'll also be releasing a smartphone app, which actually everybody will have access to, both on Androids, iPhones. You can get a lot of information right at your fingertips.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Tanya Clay House, the Public Policy Director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Tanya, when you work on Capitol Hill and you talk to some legislators in your role as public policy director, what's the response that you get on this issue?
It's overwhelming. In fact, we have been engaged in a lot of conversations with legislators on the Hill to try to figure out, you said, as you asked before, what can we do? How can we fight back? And how can we actually enact some better reforms in our election system? Because what is challenging is that you have this mythology that there's a need to have these types of restrictive identification laws because there's voter fraud, whereas that's nothing farther from the truth. In fact, there is no widespread voter fraud that's occurring. There's been numerous studies done on this, and even under the Bush prior administration, they could not even find any types of widespread voter fraud. So that's an issue. That's not something that is correct. And so what we're trying to do is actually combat the actual issue. So 90% of the issues that we get in when we get calls into the hotline is about people not being able to register to vote or having challenges with registering, and also, types of intimidation issues. I mean, that is the problem that we're seeing at the polling place. So, legislators are working right now to craft actually a big, packages, and we're hoping to see that come out in a couple of weeks on the national level, and that will kind of address some of these major issues, particularly what we talked about, voter registration. We'd love to see what we called voter registration modernization, which is reforming our registration system. So you essentially have people you vote, I mean, you register to vote, and it's done automatically. You don't have to continually register every time you move or move to another state, and because that is often the challenges that people have with trying to exercise their right to vote here in this country.
Would that almost be like a national database of registered voters?
It would. It would. And it would be something in which it takes the onus off of the individual so much to have to re-register all the time, and also places more of that burden upon the state to ensure that their electorate is registered and engaged. And so it creates a more level playing field, and you have people who are engaged and interacting with agencies all the time, and it creates this type of a database where you do have people who are, you know, whenever you're trying to sign up for any types of services, you're going to be asked, do you want to register to vote? Is this something that you want to do? And it makes a more a coordinated effort is put in place for making sure that people are registered. And right now, I mean, we have laws like the National Voter Registration Act, which requires that agencies provide opportunities for people to register to vote. But sadly, it's not being enforced enough in the states. And so this is another way to make sure that this is that people are engaged as much as possible. So we've gotten a lot of great response from legislators on the Hill. You know, Congressman Conyers, Congressman Hoyer, Congressman Clyburn, Marsha Fudge from Ohio in particular, you know, Gwen Moore from Wisconsin, states where they're having these challenges and they're seeing a lot of these issues. And so we've really been very happy to see that.
Tanya, talk about voter protections and how that fits into the larger civil rights movement.
The right to vote has historically been kind of a foundation of what those in the civil rights community have been fighting for years. I mean, I think we consider the right to vote kind of a foundation of our democracy. Just as you talk about education as being that building block to allow people to be able to engage productively in our society, so is the right to vote, because it essentially determines who is going to represent you and put in place those types of reforms and those types of laws that are going to govern our state, and it allows you to have a voice. And that is the foundation. And so that has been, you know, when we were fighting back in, you talk about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, I mean, the right to vote was right there. And with eventually the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was so historic, because it provided for the I think it reminded this country that all people have and deserve the right to be productive members of the society and be engaged and not be discriminated against. And so that is, I think, something that we wholeheartedly believe and will continue to fight for. And it's been an ongoing struggle. I mean, the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65, along, you know, previous to that with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that package was historic, but it's ongoing. You know, we've seen since that time other laws that have needed to be put in place, updates. We've had, you know, updates of and renewals of the Voting Rights Act, adding a Section 203 to ensure that language minorities also have provided materials and resources. And we've had a reaffirmation of the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And so that is something that is extremely important in the civil rights community, and truly is kind of a foundation for many of the rights we're fighting for.
Lastly, Tanya, what's your biggest concern going into the 2012 election season?
That people are not aware that and are not educated about what is happening around the right to vote. That people are going to show up at the polling place and not know that they either, number one, need a certain type of identification that they know that they didn't need before. That they think that because I voted in the last election, that that I'm not going to have a problem going to the polling place this election. Whereas sadly they may, because of some of these new restrictive laws, that people don't know where to go to get help. That's our greatest fear, and so that's why we're fighting, we're working so hard to make sure that people are aware of these about what's happening in the states around these laws, that they know how to combat them and get the necessary identification or at least know the hours in which they can vote if there are restrictions on early voting, but also know who to call. So that's the Election Protection Coalition, and that's our 866 Our Vote hotline if they need assistance, and also use a smartphone app. And so that's why we're working around the clock to make sure that we're getting this information out there and people know how to help to protect themselves.
Tanya Clayhouse, the Public Policy Director for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Tanya, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll look at new government data for Social Security reserves with Economic Policy Institute economist Monique Morrissey.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Monique Morrissey, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Monique, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jason.
So, Monique, a government report this week indicated that Social Security, the Social Security Trust Fund, will be exhausted by the year 2033. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that's about 3 years sooner than was projected in last year's report. The shortfall, the 75-year shortfall, is now $9 trillion, which is about 20% larger than it was projected last year. So this is definitely, you know, bad news for Social Security, but it's not nearly as bad as a lot of what you might read about the subject. It's actually, Social Security is actually in pretty good shape overall, and this is more a blip than a serious problem.
And so on that notion that it's a blip more than a serious problem, should people feel relatively comfortable with where things are, or what should they be thinking at this point?
Well, year shortfall is less than 1% of GDP over the next 75 years. Another way to think about it is that if we were to raise contributions, which are currently taxed at about 6.2% of earnings on both the employer and the employee side, if we were to raise that to by 1.4 percentage points, we would get rid of the shortfall. So these are manageable. This is a small fraction of wage growth over that next 75 years, and it would be pretty easy to get rid of the problem if we had the political will to do it. My preferred way of getting rid of the problem, by the way, is to eliminate the cap on taxable earnings. Right now, if you make more than $110,000, the earnings above that cap are not taxed. And so one way to get rid of most of the shortfall is to simply get rid of that cap and tax all earnings the same way, like we do with Medicare or we do with income taxes.
Monique, you mentioned possible ways to rectify this, obviously, eliminating the cap, but also adding on about 1.4% to the tax rate. How likely do you think that something like that would happen in the near term or even the long term?
Well, I do think something is going to happen before 2033. What happens in 2033, by the way, isn't that Social Security runs out of money. It just runs out of savings, which is a different thing. I mean, Social Security, just like households, have current income. So if you, you know, run your bank account down to zero, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be bankrupt. In the same way, Social Security is not going bankrupt in 2033, as people sometimes want to scare us into thinking it will. In fact, what's going to happen in 2033 is that Social Security will still have enough income to pay about 75% of benefits. And in fact, those benefits are still going to be higher than they are today's compared to today's benefits, even adjusting for inflation. But nonetheless, politicians generally don't want people to see a 25% cut in Social Security benefits. So something is going to happen before then. I would argue that even though we should do something sooner rather than later, we should also do it in a way that's very open and deliberative and fair and not be panicked into cutting benefits preemptively based on what is actually a fairly modest shortfall.
Is there any impact based on this new data on recipients either currently or down the road?
Well, not really. I mean, in the sense that only in the sense that if nothing were done, then the benefit cuts take place automatically. What's not well understood is that Social Security has to run is a in a balanced way over time. It can't actually run deficits. It can't borrow. Because of this, if nothing were done, and again, this is the worst case scenario, until 2033, at that point, benefits would be cut by 25%. Now, that's just not going to happen politically, but it's worth remembering, though, that this is what would happen automatically, and therefore, it's not the case that this is going to cause the overall federal deficit to grow, or the debt to grow, because it can't. What happens automatically in 2033 is that benefits would be cut rather than that we would borrow to pay for the difference.
You had mentioned in a recent blog post that Social Security is now running a cash flow deficit. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yes. Sometimes you will hear this often mentioned in news articles that the tax income, the contributions to Social Security right now are less than what we're paying out in benefits. That sounds bad, but it's actually somewhat meaningless because overall Social Security is still running a substantial surplus if you include interest earnings on the trust fund balances. So, to say that Social Security is running a deficit right now is to say that, for example, Paris Hilton is running a deficit because if you're not counting her trust fund earnings, it's the same way. That said, it's also normal that at some point Social Security is going to be running a deficit, which simply means it's going to be tapping into the savings in its trust fund. And this has always been planned. There's nothing wrong with this. The savings in the trust fund are there primarily to pay for the baby boomer retirement. And so inevitably at some point we're going to have to dip into them. It's not happening yet, but when it happens, it won't be it's not a bad thing. It's actually what we plan to do, and that's why we have the savings in the first place.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Monique Morrissey, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Monique, from some of the things that you've explained, it sounds very much like Social Security and the program is almost self-functioning on autopilot, if you will. If certain things happen, then automatic triggers are initiated. Is that about right?
That is about right. And another important point about Social Security that's often misunderstood is that costs are not really rising. They're not mounting year after year. What's happening is they're going to be rising as the baby boomers retire, and then they're actually going to be falling a little bit and leveling off. So right now, costs as a share of GDP, share of the economy are about 5%. They're going to rise to a little bit over 6% and then decline to 6% and stay flat. This means Social Security is not really a mounting problem, unlike Medicare. Medicare is a mounting problem not because it's a government program, but simply because healthcare costs in the United States seem to rise year after year no matter what. There's no such problem with Social Security. And Social Security, a one-time fix would pretty much solve the problem.
Given all of this that you have just stated, why is it that Social Security then is included in many political conversations as needing drastic changes or fixes?
Well, frankly, it's all about politics. In fact, if you get people like Pete Peterson, who is one of the preeminent sort of deficit hawks or self-styled deficit hawks out there, they will actually admit that Social Security doesn't contribute to the overall federal deficit, and even if you take it shortfall by itself, it's a relatively small shortfall and a relatively small part of the overall fiscal problem. But the same people who want to cut government in general are trying to, it is a big program, and so they want to cut it. And it was also part of the plan back in the day when they were trying to push for private accounts for Social Security. It's been decades in the making that people have been sort of making Social Security out to be a program that has a serious problem when it does not.
Let's talk a little bit about the benefits of Social Security in this need to preserve it, obviously not just for today's retirees, but future generations to come. How important is a program like this for the stability of our country?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. I mean, first of all, Social Security is unbelievably important in terms of the well-being of families. I mean, most retirees make a lot less than most active workers. Their household incomes are about half as large for retirees, and most retirees depend on Social Security for about two-thirds of their income. Social Security is what keeps a lot of seniors out of poverty. Most seniors are not very far above poverty, and they had very high poverty rates before Social Security. Social Security is also very important to disabled workers and a lot of children. I mean, it's not one of those things that's only for retirees. And it's also what you said about the economy is it's an important stabilizer. One of the reasons Social Security's finances have taken a hit is because the economy right now is doing poorly. But this Social Security allowed a lot of older workers who were laid off to retire and actually injected more funds into the economy right when the economy needed. In that sense, Social Security serves as an automatic stabilizer for the economy in the same way that unemployment benefits and food stamps and things like that do. The outlays tend to increase when the economy is doing badly, and it cushions some of the downturn. You know, our unemployment rate would be a lot higher right now, or not a lot, but somewhat higher right now if it weren't for Social Security.
Monique, we've had guests on in the past who have indicated that Social Security and the program really allows today's retirees to live their later years with some dignity and some independence. Would you agree with those assessments?
Absolutely. And I would, you know, emphasize that retirement is often referred to as a three-legged stool, with savings, Social Security, and pensions and 401ks, you know, being the other legs of the retirement stool. And in fact, even though for federal workers and a lot of your listeners, they're going to receive a good pension, for the average American, Social Security is much more like a bar stool. Social Security is what they live off of. Everything else is just chump change, really, compared to Social Security. And this isn't just for very low-income people. It's for the average retiree really depends on Social Security for the vast majority of their income.
In terms of the politics part of it, have you seen or heard any reactions from lawmakers on Capitol Hill about this latest government data on the program?
You know, I have not paid close attention, but right before the report came out, Senator Conrad, a Democrat, Democratic senator, was using the Social Security's projected shortfall as a reason for, you know, part of the reason for promoting the both Simpsons recommendations. Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson were the two co-chairs of President Obama's fiscal commission, and they had a very, very draconian conservative plan to cut, federal outlays. And Senator Conrad, even though he's a Democrat, is a sort of self-styled deficit hawk, and has been pushing these, the Bowles-Simpson's plan, which includes massive cuts to Social Security. I should point out that Senator Conrad is he's both retiring, and his views are not reflective of mainstream Democrats. But this is an example of how things get politicized.
Lastly, Monique, what do you think the future holds for Social Security?
I think that as long as we do not panic, and as long as we realize that attempts to preemptively cut benefits are political attacks rather than something that needs to be done in order to, quote unquote, save the program, we'll be okay. This is a very manageable shortfall. Modest and very popular changes to the program would fix the problem. And by say popular, I say that Americans across the political spectrum very strongly support Social Security and would rather raise revenues than cut benefits. And in fact, things like eliminating the cap on taxable earnings are very popular across the political spectrum. So we really don't have a problem. We have a problem inside the Beltway with a lot of people kind of creating a tempest in a teapot. But we don't have a problem with Americans at large who understand the program and its importance and support it and are also willing to contribute more in order to keep it strong for the next 75 years. But we do have a problem inside the Beltway.
Monique Marcy, economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Monique, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the Next Generation of Government Summit with GovLoop founder and president, Steve Ressler.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Steve Ressler, the founder and president of GovLoop. Steve, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the GovLoop Next Generation of Government Summit is coming up in July, the 26th and the 27th. Tell us about the summit, Steve.
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to one of the things that when I was first a Fed, so I came out of grad school and I worked with the Department of Homeland Security. There's really no one within my generation at my agency. So a couple of friends and I got together and started a happy hour that turned into a professional development organization called Young Government Leaders, which is the young professional organization for feds. And we always wanted to do kind of a training and learning event for kind of Gen X, Gen Y government leaders, and also kind of bridge that barrier between Gen X, Gen Y, and the baby boomers and really learn from each other. So a couple years ago, as GovLoop was growing, I reached out to the folks, the current president of YGL, and said, why don't we do a GovLoop Young Government Leaders Next Generation of Government Training Summit? It's really the goal of the event is to train and energize our next generation of government leaders.
That sounds fantastic. Why would a federal worker attend this summit? What will they get out of it?
Yeah, so the first thing, which I don't think we talk enough about in government, is why we get into public service. It's often because of the mission and the energy that we want to give back. So the folks in government are very different than the folks at Goldman Sachs or folks like that. We do it because we care. But often you get beat up every day. So I was talking to an acquaintance the other day who'd been in the summit, and she said she was really close to quitting government. She was, you know, her energy was low. She wasn't feeling she was able to make a change. And she said after she came to the summit, she realized there's tons of people like her. She said she got the energy to make the change, that what they're doing matter. And she said, I got really practical tips. So we really try to make this, it's a training event, so real practical tips on being a manager for the first time, how to lead organizations and change, you know, how to actually do project management well. So really try to make it the tools you need as a leader with some inspiration in there as well.
Steve, in terms of practical tips and training sessions, I noticed that you'll have one on financial literacy and also one on living a healthy lifestyle. How do those things fit into being a productive federal employee?
Yeah, so I think there's two key ways it ties in well. So first of all, financial literacy is important, I think, both at an individual and organizational level. So what we find, especially young feds, you know, and you probably talked in the show, the Roth 401k is going to come to the TSP. A lot of folks don't really understand how the TSP works. They don't understand their options. And, you know, as budgets get cut, you know, there's less of that kind of internal training on how to navigate the benefit structure, which becomes really important because agencies want their staff to be able to use the benefits, use them in the right way. And then second of all, you know, on a higher level, which we'll get into a little bit there and in some other sessions, I don't think we talk enough about how the current Fed, a lot of what they do is money and budget. So whether you're a project manager, a budget analyst, or HR person, a large part of your role more and more these days is, you know, getting a budget or a shrinking budget, finding out the best ways to use that budget, spend it on, you know, contractors, products, hiring internally. So just financial literacy is, I think, just really important for the 21st century Fed, both at an individual level. So you have your house in order at home, and then also getting your house in order at your agency.
Steve, do you find people who attend the summit and maybe participate in some of those financial literacy sessions who shore things up at home and then are also able to apply some of those same lessons to their professional lives at the workplace?
Exactly. Yeah, I think they're integrated. They're totally tied together, especially in, you know, 2012. The divide between work life, you know, is getting grayer and grayer. And if you don't have your house in order at home, you know, if you're behind on retirement, that may make you create other changes in your life, whether it's leaving for a different job or just the stress of that, which hurts your productivity at work. So just getting your house in order home, really, when you come to work, you're in a much better space when you feel comfortable. And what I love about the federal government benefits, it's not that complicated if you get just a little bit of advice. So, you know, I'm not your financial guy for today, but there's just some basic stuff of, you know, hey, every young Fed, you should be putting at least 5% in your TSP because that's the match you get. And, you know, if you don't want to think the lifestyle 2040 or 2050 retirement plan's going to get you an A-minus result. So just getting those tips, you know, helps a ton. And it's amazing how many folks don't follow that, where I meet folks that are, you know, 25 years old and ask, you know, you've been working 3 years. or what do you do with TSP? Oh, I can't afford to put any money in there yet. And I'm like, well, you just, you know, that's the worst. This is the best time, you know. Cut a Starbucks, cut a night out, and it's going to end up, you know, tens and twenties and hundreds of thousand dollars, you know, 50 years later.
Steve, at the top, you mentioned your efforts to integrate members of Gen X, Gen Y, and baby boomers. How has that gone?
You know, it works out pretty good, and this kind of comes on two pieces. So one is I find there's a lot of perceived animosity between kind of X, Y, boomers. But when you actually come at the topic with people that care and want to learn, it's easily solvable. So this partly comes out of on Gov, we do an online mentoring program where we match 50 mentors and 50 mentees. We're actually in the process of our second one right now. And we found that actually people love to share, you know, if you're a mentor, you love to give back. Most people who got into public service do because they care. They like teaching the next generation. And most mentees, you know, love to learn. It's just, how do we structure that and learn the common vernacular? So, you know, both sides, so it comes off the right way. So I know we had sessions last year, we have one this year. Just, you know, what are some practical tips? So, hey, you know, some of it's just really cultural. So, for example, when you talk about, you know, D-Day, it's not relatable to a 27-year-old. But if you say, if you can put it in the context of, hey, D-Day is very similar to 9/11 to you, and here's how it's kind of similar, and you can kind of share an emotional bond of how you think through, you know, disasters and how those work. Or, for example, with new technology, if you just say, Twitter's stupid, I don't care about new tech. But if you're open-minded enough and you say, hey, you know, I remember when email came in my organization in the 90s, and I was the young person. I was telling everyone to get on email, and everyone was pushing back. I realize Twitter's like that now, and I want to learn from you. Tell me why it matters. I'm skeptical, but I'm open to learn. So that's the biggest thing, is just both sides being open to learn. And really, there's some small tweaks just on language issues. And I've seen just some stuff myself when the mentor always talks about having a child your age, all of a sudden it hurts the relationships because you're just their child and they're kind of talking down to you. But if you focus it on a business capacity, it works a lot better.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Steve Ressler, founder and president of GovLoop. Steve, on this notion of Twitter, what role will social media play at the summit?
Yeah, so we integrated social media, and actually we just did a call for topics. We did it a couple weeks ago, so we try to make the training conference be about our members and what they want to learn about. So we asked for a call for topics, both on GovLoop. So we had a discussion forum on GovLoop. We asked questions on Twitter and Facebook. We integrated, did the in-person email as well. But so we always try to integrate social media the way we're doing it. And then also this year we have a mobile app. So it's pretty cool. We're going to do a couple contests with it, both integrating taking photos at the event, as well as integrating Twitter, so to be live tweeting from the event. And last year we took questions both from GovLoop and Twitter live in the event and streamed those. So I'm a big believer in basically blended learning. So, you know, how do you integrate online, offline to create kind of great experiences?
What can attendees learn in terms of leadership development at the summit?
Yeah, I think there's so the best thing I think about leadership in the public sector is there's two types of things that go on. So there's general leadership tips that can come from just, you know, reading the great books, learning from folks. And then there's some that are very public sector focused. So last year we had a great author who wrote this book, Change, and it was all about – it was actually called Consider. And it was a one word with a C. It's called Consider. And he had interviewed David Petraeus, Thad Allen, and talked about how do you make leadership – and actually make big changes in government, because it is different in government. There's different motives. It's not about money. It's not about ROI in the pure economic sense. A lot of it can be, there's dealing with Congress. There's dealing with the media. There's dealing with federal, state, locals, vendors. So we talk a lot about that in government. How do you actually make these big changes? And I actually think it's a great time for it because government, with the budgets shrinking, we really need to reconsider how we do things because we can't just do it the same way. So we talk a lot about that, and then we bring in people that have done it. So we've had some great folks. I know this year we're going to try to get some folks from the White House. We have some people lined up from CDC and EPA, people that have started big programs and made big changes. So that's our biggest thing, is I think you learn a lot about leadership by hearing the best practices from folks in government that have done it. And also they can talk a little bit about how hard it is. I think that's one thing we find kind of from our attendees is they feel like it's really hard, you know, trying to make change in government. And it really is, but it helps them a lot hearing, hey, this super successful person ran into the same roadblocks that I did, and I shouldn't give up. So I think a lot of people, maybe it's a cultural thing of the helicopter parents and everyone getting A's and ribbons growing up, that they're like, oh, I didn't know it was going to be this hard. I thought I just, you know, would tell my boss it's a great idea, and, you know, tomorrow things would change. So I think a lot of it's a matter of perspective, too.
Steve, if someone wants to learn more or sign up for the conference, where can they find you?
Yeah, so easiest place, nextgengov, so it's nextgengovt.com. You can actually email me personally too, it's steve@govloop.com, steve@govlop.com. Happy to share info. And we're actually doing, we're launching early next week a contest for speakers. So we're going to have three folks speak for 5 minutes at the conference that are doing something really innovative in their agency. Anyone can apply. So I encourage you to apply if you think you're doing something really cool at your agency, or maybe you just have a really good idea. We had a good idea last year, which was around how do you change the end of the fiscal year process. This person had this kind of really interesting idea of saving money there. If you have a really interesting idea like that, then submit that on our website or steve@govloop.com.
Steve, before we close out here, I noticed that GovLoop put out a great resource for aspiring feds or those within the federal sector maybe looking to change jobs, and that's your GovLoop Career Guide. Give us a quick summary of that.
Yeah, so I encourage people to check out. So what we do on GovLoop often is we take the best of what goes on every day on GovLoop in our blogs and discussions and talk to our members and create these guides. So we just launched one on careers, which it's about kind of four things. It's finding a government job, but also once you're in, how to get to the next level and find your next government job. And there's kind of great practical tips on, you know, some of this on how to navigate USA jobs, how to navigate details and opportunities like that, which people don't often know about as much. And then some real practical kind of career advice that we've gotten both from our experts and blogs and discussions online. And I think there's just a lot of stuff that's really good in there, you know, but when I talk to a lot of feds, they often come to me and they complain. They're like, hey, I'm just stuck. I'm a GS-12. I can't get ahead. I'm not on the project I want. And I said, well, you know, how do we change that? And so guides like this is really our tips of okay, you're in that situation. How do you get to the next level? Here's some real practical tips on, you know, finding a mentor, finding your next project. And maybe you do need to change agencies or divisions of your agency. If so, how do you do that and find the right jobs on USA Jobs?
And Steve, that can be downloaded from your website there at GovLoop, right?
Yep, just govloop.com. You can download it. It's free and it's just a resource. And just generally overall, we have a pretty robust career section where we found a lot of the feds on our site just love tips and advice on how to get ahead in their career. Some of that's exec coaching level, dealing with problems at a high level. Some of it's junior, trying to get to the mid-level. So we have an online mentoring program. We have a free resume review service where we review 10 resumes a month. We have the online mentors program. And then we also have a job section where we pick the top 10 government jobs from USA Jobs by category, acquisitions, technology, communications each week, and send those out.
Steve Ressler, founder and president of GovLoop. Always fun having you on the program, Steve. Thanks for taking the time today.
Cool. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE 14th District National Representative Johnny Walker, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law Public Policy Director Tanya Clayhouse, Economic Policy Institute economist Monique Morrissey, and GovLoop founder and president Steve Ressler. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government.